Well, thank you, Reid. And thanks everybody here for having me. Very awesome to be at the Perimeter Institute. So today I'm going to be talking about, the title of the presentation is Nuclear Astrophysics, Unknown Knowns, and I'll kind of go into what that means. Okay. So one question that I get asked a lot, why study neutron stars? Why do we do this in the first place? And obviously many people here might have some, you know, like very good idea why we study neutron stars, but maybe just to kind of make this a bit more precise, there are these two sort of dimensionless numbers that quantify why neutron stars are so interesting. The first one is this general relativity parameter, gm over rc squared. Inside of, in the case of neutron stars, this parameter can approach 1/3. 1/2 is the limit at which this quantity would imply that the compact object we're studying is a black hole. So this is pretty close to the maximum possible value that this can have. A compact object can't get much greater than that. So that's saying that general relativity is very important in this regime when this number is not, when it's not small compared to one. And there's also this fact that nuclear matter it has uncertain properties above the density of nuclear saturation, which is the density of atomic nuclei. So the reason that, you know, nuclei have this density is because there are certain features of the strong force that cause this density in particular to be the relevant density for matter to saturate at. So inside of these neutron stars, the matter is actually being squeezed closer together than this density. So this number can be, in the cores of neutron stars, somewhere between 4 and 7, and that's unknown. We don't really know what the maximum possible density of. In this case, this represents the number density of baryons, which is a relevant quantity because baryons are conserved. So it's a helpful kind of pointer to the measure of density inside of these stars. And this is telling us that neutron stars are giving us laboratories to study nuclear physics along with general relativity. Another dichotomy that we can set up for why to study neutron stars is, one is to better understand current theories of physics. So maybe you could think that, for example, general relativity is in principle perfectly well known. We know exactly what general relativity is. We also know what the standard model is, in the sense that we can write down a Lagrangian for both of these theories and try to compute things. But in both of these cases, computing things is hard. And neutron stars give us a picture of what's actually happening in these theories in the real world. So what are the practical implications of these theories? So I'm kind of, you know, like making a bit of a generalization here, but I'm classifying sort of the things that we in principle know about physical theories today, so like general relativity and the standard model, are sort of like unknown knowns. There are things we know, but there are properties of these theories that are actually unknown because, for example, they can't be computed effectively. And then there's also, of course, new physics that could potentially appear, and neutron stars are an excellent candidate to look for new physics because, for example, things like this. If you're looking for new physics, you want to look at higher energies, higher densities, new interactions that might appear. This is a very promising way to probe these higher densities and energies. And the same thing in general relativity. There are curvature terms that become larger and larger, so inside of the cores of neutron stars. And these might lead to other terms in a theory of gravity, a general theory of gravity becoming relevant. And so that might also lead to violations of general relativity. So this is kind of another way to think about why we're studying neutron stars. And I'm going to focus today sort of on these unknown knowns. This is an example of the phase diagram of quantum chromodynamics, which is essentially, in the standard model, what we expect to happen when matter gets incredibly dense. So right around here is where we're happy to live right now with nuclei that, well, at least the nuclear matter that we experience is generally in about this phase. And inside of neutron star cores, the chemical potential, which is related to the positively with the number density of baryons, gets quite a bit higher. And we don't really know where the neutron stars will lie. They'll be somewhere around here because they'll have generally low temperature relative to their density. But we're not sure if we're going to reach a phase transition inside of neutron stars. We don't know what the properties of matter are like necessarily in this region. It turns out the standard model is very difficult to compute at these densities. So quantum chromodynamics has details that make it difficult to actually compute these predictions. And And a simple example of how we can infer the equation of state, so the relationship between pressure and density inside of these neutron stars, using astrophysics, so using astrophysical data. Originally, when neutron stars were hypothesized, it was 1933, the neutron had just been discovered, and the hypothesis was essentially that a white dwarf, which is held up by electron degeneracy pressure, could collapse into a neutron star, which would be supported by neutron degeneracy pressure. Well, we now know that this 5/3 polytrope, which comes from degenerate neutron matter, with the relevant parameters for neutrons, leads to an MR curve. So on this axis, we have the mass in solar masses, and on this, we have the radius in kilometers, which peaks less than one solar mass. So this is a feature of general relativity. There's a maximum mass for neutron stars. Well, for any really dense compact object where general relativity is relevant, there will be a maximum mass. And this maximum mass is quite a bit lower than the most massive observed pulsar, which we expect, of course, to be a neutron star. This is implying that this is not the correct model for the equation of state of dense materials.
So this part of is based on non-relativistic equation?
Yes.
But for computing this MR curve, you're assuming general relativity?
So we do assume general relativity. So I'll clarify. The neutrons inside of a neutron star in this type of calculation are generally non-relativistic in the sense that their energy is not yet at their rest mass. So they can be approximated as being non-relativistic. But the astrophysical calculations, so this is solving the TOV equations, which are fully relativistic. It's just the model for the matter, the microphysics, that is a non-relativistic approximation. But yeah, the big point here is that if you just take the simplest model, perhaps of a neutron star you could imagine, which was the first one hypothesized, it turns out that we have conclusive evidence now that this could not possibly be the equation of state of matter inside of these neutron stars. And this gives us a way to rule out this equation of state from being the real implication of the standard model at these high densities. And sort of schematically is represented over here by, we have neutron star properties that we observe. We can compute neutron star properties from the equation of state. And because of this, we can infer the equation of state from the neutron star properties. Although in practice, we have to infer both simultaneously. Go into that a bit later. In more general terms, what we want to do is establish a probability distribution on candidate equations of state. So this is sort of represented by this calculation. The probability of an equation of state candidate given some data, which in this case is going to be astrophysical data, is the probability of the equation of state candidate given all of the data, which is, this is Bayes' rule, which I'm sure many people are familiar with, the likelihood times the prior. A bit misformatted. But the essential parts of these equations are essentially the likelihood and the prior. And the first thing I'm going to focus on is the prior. So the key different ways you could try and establish a prior on equations of state, well, there's two different strategies you could take. You could try and sort of take calculations directly from nuclear theory and say only equation of state candidates that have exact grounding in nuclear theory, i.e. that are computed directly from nuclear theory, should be considered to have any prior weight or any, you know, should we consider these even in our analyses. Instead, usually what's done in astrophysics is a phenomenological approach, where you try and build a model of the equation of state that will reproduce things like nuclear theory, but might also produce equation of state candidates, so models of the equation of state that don't actually have any perfect nuclear theory analog. So they might have behavior that might not yet have grounding in nuclear theory, but potentially could in the future. And focusing on phenomenological models for the rest of this talk, because again, this is sort of what's been relevant to astrophysics for the most part. So the first type of model that I'm going to be talking about for the equation of state are parametric models. And in these cases, what you typically do is build a phenomenological form for the model of the equation of state. So these are three different examples. There's the spectral model, which is essentially the idea is you have an equation of state, you have an adiabatic index that's parameterized, and the parameters, these little gamma i's up here, you can place a prior on those And by sampling parameters, you effectively sample equations of state. Now, this diagram is something that I'll be showing a lot, but it might be a bit confusing. So these black lines, these like thin black lines, represent candidates drawn from this model. And these, in this case, these candidates sort of satisfy some reasonability criteria just for the purposes of presentation. But this shaded region and the region between these dashed lines represents a 90% credible region for the pressure as a function of the density. So this is, again, the rest mass density of baryons, which is a convenient quantity for us to use. But it's a way of representing the uncertainty in the equation of state under this model. And again, so exactly what's happening here is with the dashed lines, we're just including the heavy pulsar data and plotting what we infer for the pressure as a function of density. And here we're plotting, given all of our astrophysical data that we're using. And I'll go into this a bit more later, how this works. But the main point of this diagram is to understand that it represents the uncertainty in the equation of state under this model by showing you the different possible values of the pressure at a certain density. And again, we're using three different models here and sort of touch on these later. One of the problems that these types of parametric models face is that when you write down a functional form, you have to choose, which in a way we call this like an ad hoc choice, of how you're going to write down the functional form. And in general, this will leave an imprint on your equation of state model because the particular choices you make will limit possible types of equations of state you can represent. So another strategy that was pioneered by Reed and Phil is to use a non-parametric model. Non-parametric here, it's not exactly clear what it means. So it's difficult to exactly draw the line between non-parametric and parametric, but the big point of this particular non-parametric model, the Gaussian process, is that you're placing a prior on correlations between density scales in the equation of state. So the fundamental idea is you try and tabulate a draw so of this quantity, this phi variable, which is somehow a function of the speed of sound at a particular pressure. And the idea is at many different pressure points, you set up a multivariate Gaussian. You can then basically fix the covariance of this Gaussian and the mean of the Gaussian. And you can draw many, many samples. And this form is set up basically just because if you draw in this variable, you're guaranteed to come out with an equation of state which is stable in the sense that the pressure is increasing as a function of density, and also causal in the sense that the speed of sound is less than the speed of light, which are two criteria that we sort of, they're sort of basic physical criteria that are necessary for an equation of state model to be considered realistic. And so what's helpful about this model is that we can, based on how we want these equations of state models to behave, we can change the parameters of the covariance kernel, and it can give us a variety of different behavior, which is sort of what we're hoping for in a phenomenological analysis. Remember, again, the point was possibly to explore possible equations of state that might not be produced by a current nuclear model. And nuclear models above twice the density of atomic nuclei, so this rho nu parameter, are fairly unreliable because we don't know what the relevant degrees of freedom inside of the standard model are here. So even if you can come up with an ansatz for what the relevant degrees of freedom or for how to compute the equation of state up here, you don't know sort of what the correct Lagrangian is even to write down, the correct effective Lagrangian to write down is at these densities. So
I don't know what it is. This non-parametric thing is interesting. So for let's say LIGO bubble, people try to model the population using, let's say, powers or Gaussians or this thing. These are parametric models, some hyperparameters. Has anyone tried to use this kind of Gaussian process in non-parametric models for this population?
Yeah. So this has been done. People have been starting to build more and more non-parametric models. And I think even in the LVK population analysis, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, for 03, there was a mass model which was non-parametric, right? Or strictly, like, non-parametric.
I mean, this goes back to what I said, there's no, like, universally accepted definition that separates parametric from non-parametric, but people are in a lot of ways that you are meant to suggest it not. And so I just pointed out in the 03 paper, or paper, there's some models, there are more looking at literature all the time. One of the actual problems, I can get into this for the EOS context, is you can write down these flexible things, but then kind of what do you do with that? Like, how do you interpret it? It's now you have a much more complicated piece in some sense, because you don't just have like three numbers that you're going to plot.
Yeah. Yeah, this, I mean, yeah, a lot of these ideas are related. So, I mean, that's a very good point, that a lot of these modeling questions are quite universal to the regime we're moving into in astrophysics, where there is a ridiculous amount of data that we're going to have access to. And so data-driven models become more appealing, but data-driven models are also harder to interpret. I'm just going to briefly touch on what kind of astrophysical data we're using, because it's sort of illustrative of the actual type of problems that we have to solve. So that this, again, is, for people that are familiar with this language, this is sort of what is going into the likelihood of our calculation. The first thing, this is sort of my favorite, is gravitational waves. So tidal effects inside of gravitational waves, so these binary neutron stars, when they merge, they sort of tidally distort each other. And this tidal distortion adds to the quadrupole moment and causes the merger to accelerate. And so in the last few milliseconds, actually, before the merger, so this is data from GW170817 from the Livingston detector, in the last few milliseconds of the merger, the tidal deformability of these neutron stars leaves an imprint on the gravitational wave signal, which we can extract by, again, using a Bayesian strategy. And from that, we can infer what the tidal deformabilities, and also we can infer the masses of these from the chirp, and just in general from the signal, we can infer all of these things simultaneously, and it gives us a way to constrain the pressure as a function of density. The interpretation of this is generally that when you have a very stiff equation of state, which means the pressure is high as a function of density, you get larger stars, and larger stars are more deformable. The more deformable your star is, the larger the signal, the impact on the signal is in this region. So in 170817, for example, the impact of the tidal parameters on the signal appeared to be somewhat relatively low. And so the pressure as a function of density curve responds by dropping. So again, now we, after 170817, this green shaded region, you can see the expected pressure as a function of density shrinking relative to just including heavy pulsar observations. These heavy pulsar observations you can kind of think of as our baseline in this context. They're very well established and they're relatively accurate. So again, the GWs here represents both 170817 and the second binary neutron star observation, 190425, which is somewhat less informative than 170817, like quite a large margin. The second type of data that we're using, besides gravitational waves and heavy pulsars, I guess the third type of data is these X-ray pulse profiles from pulsars that are active in X-rays. And so this is being done by a collaboration using an instrument on the International Space Station currently called NICER, which stands for the Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer. They do something relatively amazing, in my opinion, in that they can measure the gravitational lensing of these X-ray hotspots as these stars orbit. And, well, they also measure other relativistic parameters, such as the Doppler shift. But the gravitational lensing is a very interesting point, because by using this gravitational lensing, they're able to constrain the compactness of the star, which is an important quantity, again, because the equation of state, in general, if you have a stiffer equation of state, the neutron star is more extended and it's less compact. And so what in this case, J0740, the most massive known pulsar, what these teams have been able to do is constrain the mass and the radius of this neutron star, and they're able to effectively lower bound the radius. And what we were able to do with GW170817 was effectively lower bound or upper bound the radius by upper bounding the tidal deformability. So these constraints are really complementary, and that's actually quite nice for us because sort of you can see gravitational waves pushed you down. The nicer observations in the dark blue push you up, and it leads to better constraints overall, and the pressure is a function of density. This is mainly just to say that there are different types of astrophysical probes we're using. These probes are relatively new. Both of these strategies have been around for less than 10 years now. And they are, in many cases, giving complementary measurements. And they're also giving measurements at slightly different density scales. Heavy pulsars are very constraining up at very high densities, and gravitational waves at lower densities. And these nicer observations are spread out a little bit over a larger region. But the fact that we have to incorporate all of these measurements at different density scales is sort of telling you why we needed to infer the equation of state in the first place, because we want a unified model for all of these different observations, right? And that basically implies that you have to figure out what are the correlations between density scales to tell you what should the correlations be between these experiments or between these different data sets in some sense, right? And just a brief aside, so one of the things that I've been working on here with Reed recently is when we do our analysis, we have to, in order to compute any particular likelihood, because we're doing an astrophysical analysis, we are going not just from the equation of state to the astrophysical data, but we have to marginalize over the possible neutron star sources. So what this is saying is that we need to know what are the probability that we got this neutron star source, and then what is the possibility the data in our detector came from an event involving this neutron star source. And the caveat is that this doesn't just depend on the equation of state, it also depends on the fundamental astrophysical population of neutron stars. So currently what we've been doing is sort of choosing an ad hoc model for the population, and there was some, this is sort of an analysis we did in another paper that showed that at the level of, for example, J0740, the exact population model you used didn't matter, so this ad hoc assumption was sort of okay, but we know going into the future, when we have a lot more neutron stars that we measure, accurately modeling the population will be a factor that will be essential. So we'll need to simultaneously infer both the equation of state and the population model. And in general, these slides are sort of just to say that there are still limitations to our analysis. So no matter what, there's going to be things like gravitational wave waveforms, which are, you know, very well studied, but in certain cases there are problems. Or, you know, in interpretations of these astrophysical data, I mean, so for example, measuring the radius of J0740, I'm just going to kind of touch on this a little bit. This thing is about, you know, 11, 12 kilometers across, maybe 13, depending on where in the uncertainty band you look. But this thing is like 4,500 light years away. So like trying to measure this is like trying to measure the size of an oxygen molecule in Seattle from here, right? It's just absurd. And so no matter what, there's always going to be limitations in our analysis. But I think it's kind of remarkable that we've been able to get as far as we have, given the, and a lot of this is thanks to like excellent work on the part of instrumentalists and experimenters. So just going forward, these are sort of things we want to think about. And this is one way that, in terms of data analysis, we think we can move forward on this problem. So now sort of...
Mm-hmm. So are you trying to say that this population will change your prior?
So prior here is kind of a subtle word. let me clarify. So this is a prior on possible neutron star sources. So there's also what might be called a hyper prior, or you know, a prior one level up in our analysis on the equation of state and on the population model. So currently our prior on the population model is trivial. It's just a delta function at whatever population we decided to use. But the point is that, and this is sort of three different delta function choices, kind of, that, so basically the idea is by currently, this assumption is having a minimal effect at sort of The only place that it has a real effect is in this maximum mass parameter, where we're quite uncertain anyway. We don't really have probes of these types of neutron stars yet, so we can't really say anything with very high confidence. But the
so you just said if we have more data, do you expect that these assumptions will become less and less important, or
what? Well, no, the assumptions will become so. What we'll do is sort of transition the analysis strategy entirely to not make any of these assumptions. Like, we would infer, so the different cases, maybe this is a sort of a ridiculous assumption, because when I won't really, it sort of has to do with the details of J0740, but these are two pretty easy to interpret assumptions. This one is saying that there is an astrophysical limit to the mass of neutron stars. So this, in this case, is saying, you know, it doesn't matter what equation of state there is, the universe can't make neutron stars larger than 2.3 solar masses, because there just isn't an astrophysical channel available to do it, right? And if you assume that, it turns out that you don't rule out the possibility that the maximum TOV mass is as high, because it's possible that we haven't seen a neutron star out here at these high masses just because the universe hasn't created it yet. It doesn't tell you anything about the nuclear matter. Whereas if you assume that any mass less than the TOV mass, so the maximum mass allowed by nuclear matter of a neutron star, can be formed, then what happens is you conclude that, well, there probably isn't a neutron star of this mass, and it's probably not possible based on nuclear theory, because if it could have happened, it would have happened, and we would have seen it. And this has to do with the details of the analysis, but the point is, these are two different assumptions you can make. And in the future, we hope not to make either of these assumptions. We hope to choose between them using the data.
Let's say more data, better data. Is it possible that the data is so good that these assumptions don't matter? I mean, the data will tell you the true distribution.
Well, if you made one of these two assumptions, it would be forced. Like, you wouldn't be able to. It's possible you can misestimate the equation of state. It's possible that if you assume the wrong thing here, it's like it breaks your entire analysis. It wouldn't just go away because of the data. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe a way to say this is that exactly what you said, well, when the data is really good, you, as I was saying, you don't have to make any assumptions. You can just learn everything at the same time from all the data. So if you then did make one of the assumptions, like that whole data thing, when there's good data, but what I was working on and thinking about is like just learn.
So kind of now getting back to the main point, the posterior that we measure, so when I've been plotting these kind of shaded regions, they're the ones with astro labeled, which indicates the posterior is based on astrophysical data. They're these shaded blue and yellow regions respectively. They're composed of both a prior and a likelihood. So the prior on the equation of state and the astrophysical likelihood of the equation of state. And one of the big things we wanted to target is what happens if you just vary the prior and you examine what happens to the posteriors. So these are two different plots you can make to try and examine what's happening. Again, this one I've talked about before, but this is a comparison laying the inferred distribution with the spectral model on top of the nonparametric model. And you might notice that what's happening down here is that the nonparametric model is quite a bit wider, but this is because of prior limitations of the spectral model. So we don't, the model isn't really claiming to infer the equation of state. The question is kind of what's happening up here. These are the regions of, these are the density scales that are relevant to the actual astrophysical inference. And they're actually not that different in these density scales, but by projecting into a different plane, so by studying the maximum TOV mass and the radius of a 1.4 solar mass star, which are two quantities that are associated with every equation of state candidate, these are 90% credible region bubbles here. By comparing these, we can see that there's actually some discrepancy between these two models. And one way of viewing this a little bit differently is to choose we can sort of reweight both of our models, so they're maximally agnostic in the maximum TOV mass, which is reasonable because we don't really know the maximum TOV mass at all. It's sort of the quantity that we're measuring the most poorly right now. what you can see is even though these two models have the same prior on this quantity, this maximum TUV mass, the nonparametric model predicts quite a bit higher maximum mass neutron stars than the spectral model. What's going on here? Well, there is sort of a one way to view this, which is that this spectral model here has some relationship between the radius of a 1.4 solar mass star and the maximum TUV mass. And so does the nonparametric one, a priori, so these blue and orange dashed lines. And there is this result from Vicky Calagera and Gordon Boehm, which it says that there is a certain region of parameter space which is excluded because pressure is essentially responsible for, so a larger pressure in like 2 to 3 times nuclear saturation density range increases the radius of your star, and pressure at very high densities, so 5 times nuclear saturation or more, increases the maximum mass. And if the pressure is not high enough in the middle of the star, then you have a low R1.4, and that also implies that it can't get very high in the highest densities, because there's sort of a limitation that says the pressure has to be, the difference in pressures has to be bounded to something by this, like, something proportional to the speed of light, which is this causality constraint. So this bound is sort of a theoretical limit to where the models can go. And one thing we noticed is that the nonparametric model is much closer to this theoretical bound than the spectral bound. And it turns out that this is actually what's responsible. This little blip here is the same as that blip up there. And this is an indication that there's some modeling reasons. Maybe a way to say this is that this gap between this causality theoretical limit here and the actual model, the range of the model, is due to modeling, not due to underlying fundamental physics. And therefore, we can kind of say, well, it's this correlation between Mmax and R1.4 that's causing this problem. And so this tighter correlation, the one that's not due to underlying physics but is due to the modeling assumptions, is what's leading to this discrepancy. Now, I think one of the key points here to make is that there's a relationship between astrophysical information and microscopic information, so between pressures and densities and masses and radii, there's going to be a relationship between correlations between astrophysical observables, and correlations between density scales. So before, what we saw was correlations between masses and radii, and here what we see is correlations between density scales. I'm going to kind of dig into how do we do this. The idea is you take our current astrophysical posterior, and you assume that we have information about some other density scale. So if we knew the equation of state very precisely near twice nuclear saturation, which we don't, again, this is just a mock constraint, this is something we made up, but say we did, well, we can ask what would happen to the equation of state posterior if we had that information. In the nonparametric model, you can see what happens is we learn a lot at that point at twice nuclear saturation. We know the pressure very well there, which makes sense. But in the spectral model, you can see that we don't only learn about the equation of state here, we somehow learn about the equation of state everywhere. So the interpretation we have of this is that it's correlations between density scales in these models, which is causing you to learn information about these other parts of the equation of state, given just this bit of information, and you don't see that in this model. And to maybe add a little bit more, perspective to this, this is using the other parametric models we use, so a speed of sound parameterization, which parameterizes the speed of sound directly, or a piecewise polytrope model, which just is expanding the adiabatic index as a piecewise function. We see the same things happening. For example, we apply the constraint here, piecewise polytrope model, you learn something up at 4 times saturation density. In the speed of sound model, you apply the constraint here, you learn something at 6 times saturation density. And again, these two plots you saw before, the problem we see in this is that if it turns out that these correlations are not due to physics, they're actually just due to modeling, then this information you learn is not actually due to physics, it's just due to modeling. So this additional information you're gaining in these parametric models is due to correlations that were implicit in the prior, which you couldn't necessarily have seen before you applied the data. And this is kind of a common theme here, that sometimes these correlations only become obvious in the posterior. And really, only by comparing multiple different models is it obvious that they are due to the prior choices you've made. Because, again, in this case, we're holding the likelihood the same for all of these. So at least the likelihood model, the actual likelihood evaluations will be slightly different. But the point is that this must be due to the prior, because that's the only variable we're changing, right? And we're getting different results.
Sorry, Isaac, you couldn't, did you need more models comparing across different models to realize everything due to the prior? I mean, could you, if you had only one model, would you not just explore the influence of the prior and conclude it from there?
So yeah, we did do that. I mean, I think there is some difficulty in and I'll kind of touch on this in a second about what happens when you try and change the prior. But I mean, that's true. You can just change the prior and notice that these types of correlations will change, but it's sometimes more difficult to interpret the results. So now, like, one of the strategies we took in this paper was to try and quantify these correlations. And, well, essentially what we're going to do is we're going to figure out, given two different pressures, can we compute how much information is shared by these pressures under these different distributions? So this is a lot of text, but I'm going to kind of try and explain it piece by piece. The idea is, given a point A and a point B, you have some distribution on the pressures at point A and point B. So this is, you can kind of think of it, there's a joint distribution, which is just all of the information, the pressure at point A and point B. Then there are the marginal distributions, so that's where you marginalize over all the information about B at A and A at B. And this quantity represents the shared information between these two pressures. Another way to view this, which was really helpful for me, is that this is also a KL divergence. So it's essentially a measure of cross entropy between these two distributions, where you just look at this part for a second, the part that's outlined in red. This is the difference in information you get about the pressure at B, so this is the probability at B, conditioning on A versus not conditioning on A. So this is no conditional information on A, and this is conditional information on the pressure at A. So this is quantifying how much do you actually learn by knowing about PA, how much do you learn about PB by learning about PA. And changing this distribution, this P of PA to some other distribution, is sort of it's analogous to adding this tight measurement here. And you could imagine you go to the extreme, if this were a delta function, if you knew this exactly, then this would collapse to literally the KL divergence conditioning on exactly that pressure point. And there's some caveats here that are, I mean, they're important for the quantities, but they're not incredibly important for the overall idea. But the problem is that this measure actually scales with the marginal uncertainties in these distributions, which, if I told you that I wanted to make this mutual information small, because I want these two points to share very little information, I don't want that to happen by just making the marginal distributions very small. That would be a poor strategy, to just try and a priori constrain the equation of state everywhere in order to make the statistic better, right? That would be a bad idea. So the goal is we want to make this mutual information small while keeping the marginal distributions broad. And in the nonparametric model, we find we can do this quite successfully. So this is, just to highlight these, the nonparametric model, we can make this statistic, which is, this is a generalization of what I've explained before, but it's the mutual information of all of these pressures. And compared to the spectral model, mutual information is much smaller, which is a good sign. It means there's less information about higher pressures or lower pressures entering into any particular value of the pressure. But also the marginal distributions are quite broad. So those bars are meant to just guide the eye and show that in this particular distribution, the marginal distributions are quite a bit larger. I mean, the marginal distribution really is the width of the curve. in this case. But yes, the big point here is that in the non-parametric model, you find that you're sharing less information among pressure points, which is a sign that there's fewer correlations built into your model, which is also a sign that if you do find correlations in your analysis, they're less likely due to your prior and more likely due to actual underlying astrophysics, or more fundamentally due to the equation of state itself. So these numbers represent the mutual information when we, for example, just use the heavy pulsar observations, which we were kind of considering our baseline, or using astrophysical observations, we can compute the same quantity. Like, so we have a different distribution. Again, the idea of kind of like adding the measurement. And then finally, this one is actually what this dark blue plot represents. So this is the mutual information. This is the mutual information that we find by just using heavy pulsar posteriors. So we can compute this quantity, maybe up here it's illustrated that there's some probability distributions here. So the question is, well, what probability distributions do we use? So in the heavy pulsar case, the probability distributions we use are the ones induced by, maybe like you can see these dark blue dotted lines. They represent some astrophysical data has been incorporated into this.
That's the expression up there, log E1.0.
Yeah. So this, the problem is actually writing out this expression. So this is for two pressures.
Okay.
It generalizes to five pressures here, but you can imagine the strategy is sort of the same. You just write down this integral and you have comma PC, comma PD. Here go all of the marginal distributions and the same thing goes here.
So is it true that if you add more data points, then the overlap you expect to be smaller than?
If you add more data, in general, the mutual information will shrink, all of the things being equal, because the marginal distributions will shrink. Now, it's also possible that mutual information is changing due to the underlying nature of the correlations changing, which is also something interesting. But I think most of this effect of this shrinking here is just because the curve itself shrinks. So the overall uncertainty scale kind of shrinks. But the main thing here is to compare between this number and that number, because that's sort of apples to apples comparison, at least we hypothesize. to clarify, this is an exponential quantity. So this is order of magnitude or something better by this statistic. What time is it? Okay. One last thing that we sort of did in this paper was try and compare what happens if you inject actual astrophysical data from both the spectral model and from the non-parametric model, and try and recover it using gravitational waves and electromagnetic observations. This test is sort of, it's not really meant to be a conclusive, because we intentionally injected this on top, in a region of parameter space where we knew the spectral model could not recover it. The point was more to investigate what would it look like if you tried to recover this, this sort of equation of state with the spectral model in a region where it was not going to work out. And the answer is, well, you'll find basically disagreements in the radius. So this is actually not a serious tension, but they both disagree with the true injected value, because the electromagnetic observations are able to probe very high density observations, or very high density scales. These observations probe very high density scales. And the gravitational waves tend to probe lower density scales, because we can't, the very highest mass binary neutron stars don't give us very much gravitational information. They're more like point particles rather than like extended objects. And this was essentially the conclusion that you'll probably see some tension between these two different scales, because if you have an incorrect model, then you'll sort of expect that the if you're probing it at different places, in one part you'll be forced to choose the value that's consistent with your model at the high densities, and you'll extend incorrectly to the low densities, or vice versa. You'll choose the model that's consistent at low densities and extrapolate incorrectly into the high densities. So another question is, why can't we just modify the parametric models to get more flexibility? And this kind of also answers the question, what happens if you try and vary the prior on the parameters? The problem is these models are very fine-tuned. So for example, the spectral model attempting to extend the spectral model is very difficult, because if you change it even just a little bit, most of the models it produces become unphysical. Trying to sort of make these changes without breaking the model itself are very difficult, and that includes modifying the priors. So you can modify the priors to some extent, but the range of physical prior distributions on the equation of state, even when you change the prior on parameters, doesn't change very much, which is a limitation of these models. You sort of need to make the model more flexible before the prior can actually do any additional work in making the model more flexible. And this is hard because in general, these models need overhaul type changes to make them more flexible, which is a thing people are definitely working on, and people are definitely making improvements to these models, but it's still non-trivial. And so from my point of view, the best thing you should try and do whenever you're working with a model, the equation of state, is to understand the limitations, which I think is just a good approach to take in general. Finally, sort of the last point here is that correlations are not necessarily bad. I've been talking about correlations as if they were bad, but this is not really the case. The thing that we're worried about is when you go into an inference from for example, an astrophysical inference, having correlations built into your prior forces these correlations to appear in the posterior. If they're not physical, then you'll end up with unphysical correlations in your posterior. But for example, Reed and Phil and some other authors did a work where they investigated what happens if you condition this Gaussian process on nuclear theory at low densities. So the light green curve is sort of the prior from what we've been looking at before, and then these gray bands are increasing amounts of nuclear information being added into the model, and what we find is the Gaussian process is perfectly able to incorporate these correlations. So if you believe there are actual physical correlations, then the model can handle it. And eventually the goal should be to infer these correlations, right? So you can, from all of your different sources of data, nuclear theory perhaps as well, you can infer all of these correlations and build a unified model that you expect to have physical grounding for every correlation that appears. And then there's some caveats here that, correlations, while they might hamper your inference, they can actually help, for example, in hydrodynamical simulations, because the pressure as a function of density is more predictable. But then there's the question of what happens if the true equation of state is not actually smooth. And then you have to worry about, you know, are we modeling, mismodeling, whatever. The point is that because there's so much uncertainty in the equation of state, questions such as what is the best model for the equation of state are domain specific, and it's important to think about it before you, you know, try and draw some conclusion. It's good to be honest about what your assumptions are, understand what assumptions you're building into your model, and to quote Albert Einstein, the equation of state model should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. In conclusion, phenomenological models of the nuclear equation of state can build in correlations to the equation of state, and this is sort of just a fundamental idea that if you have a parameterized form for a model, you'll find that this parameterized form is requiring all of your models to behave in a certain way, which is to say that they have to follow the form that you give it. Non-parametric models, such as the Gaussian process model, they can provide more flexibility in the inference, but they're not going to necessarily guarantee that the flexibility you're adding is necessarily physical in any way. You sort of have to consider for yourself, what are the physical correlations I want to build in? So you can choose a Gaussian process model with very strict correlations, and you'll get a result that builds in those strict correlations. Your posterior will build those in. And so, sort of to end, the point should be, in my opinion, that you should take a lot of care when you're trying to guarantee models fit their applications and understand each of the limitations of these models, because they might be very different from other models, and one of the ways that I think you can do this most effectively is to compare many different models in any particular analysis and see how they agree and disagree. So thanks, everybody.
Okay, do we have any questions on the online audience?
Do we have any questions for Isaac? And you mentioned the equation experience and some discontinuity. How do you deal with that, your parametric model?
So the Gaussian process can naturally produce equations of state with very sharp features in the speed of sound, which is sort of what, I mean, a phase transition would be characterized by a drop to zero in the speed of sound, essentially over zero density scale. The Gaussian process can produce things like this. So the Gaussian process is essentially just sampling random curves in the speed of sound space that obey some requirements, and these are included in the support for this Gaussian. So we know we produce these. We can actually look at the models that have phase transitions in them, but that's still ongoing work to try and figure out how to actually model these in a way that makes them predictably resemble the types of phase transitions that will, like nuclear theorists predict, will appear in nuclear matter. Because just because you can produce it doesn't mean computationally you'll necessarily produce the types of things you want to find.
So this, so this Gaussian random process. So when you want to model the equation state, right? So we want to have the flexibility, but we also want this thing to be economic. So we don't want this thing to be too flexible with too many parameters. So, uh-huh. Is the Gaussian random process the optimal choice?
I don't know if there is necessarily going to be an optimal choice. I think the Gaussian process, the key is that it's a Gaussian. So the distribution you induce is simple. And I think that's maybe the reason why right now it's preferable. Because it's...
For example, are you implicitly assign some weight or prior on some, given equation state or something.
Mm-hmm.
Your answer.
Yeah, so it does. I mean, depending on the prior you put on the hyperparameter, so on the correlations essentially, and the mean of the distribution, so that will change the types of draws you get. It will change your prior. It will change your posterior. I think we don't really know what the optimal choice. I mean, again, in principle, you should infer this along with everything else. You should infer what the correct choice of these parameters were that gave you the best models, you know, a posteriori. But I think right now, like, we do know that getting a lot of really accurate models is computationally more challenging, or physically reasonable models, maybe models that are really consistent with our current astrophysical data and nuclear theory, is challenging with the Gaussian process if you don't add in a lot of correlations. So what I'm saying is, if you make your model very agnostic, you'll get a lot of garbage, right? And like, I think it's sort of a matter of choice, like where you draw the line between enforcing more and more requirements and getting in principle better and better draws versus when have you enforced too many requirements and you've started to ignore possibilities that are actually physically possible, right? And in this case, it might be you could make it, you never draw EOSs with phase transitions. And most EOSs with phase transitions are physically not realizable, right? They're not particularly good models of the equation of state, as we know now. But if you do take out the one true phase transition model, then you kind of lose.
I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, let's say in the future, we will have better theoretical understandings on the equation of state. So in addition to, let's say, the causality constraint, we will have other theoretical constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Is it easy to incorporate these kind of constraints into this framework of Gaussian random process?
Yeah, I mean, so this was sort of what was done on this paper. where you take these constraints from nuclear theory and you build them into your models. And this is, again, showing as you add more and more data what happens. And in general, I think it's much easier with the Gaussian process model, where you parameterize these correlations, than with the parametric models, where you have to try and interpret the parameters, which are oftentimes just bizarre. Like, I don't necessarily know how to interpret how I should change my priors on these parameters in order to get reasonable. I mean, in this case, it's somewhat clear. But otherwise, it can be quite difficult to, you know, how do you actually incorporate this data? I don't know.
Can you go back to the car on the T-pop?
Yeah.
So one of the really great things about the way that we, like, the Gaussian process gives you, what I would argue, a clear access to where you're putting in your theoretical model, is if you look at the middle panel, you're red, between the red curves, which I think is called out, is that's when we have no theoretical knowledge of low densities, and then the dark shaded at low densities, there's a huge difference, right? And that's because we're saying we have good theoretical knowledge. But if you look at the top, at high densities, the grays line up with the red perfectly. And so what has actually happened there is for the different shadings for the gray, we stop crossing the theory at different densities, and then we transition to this completely model-agnostic thing. So if we have a very good theoretical calculation that we trust a saturation or 2x saturation, we can very clearly, in a controlled way, stop crossing, like, include the full uncertainty in that theory calculation, but then stop and then transition immediately back to this very flexible model of high densities. And we can see that, like, there's no change in the inference at high densities, even though we changed a lot of things at low densities. But the argument is that we have intentionally broken correlations between those density scales with this approach that it may be very difficult to do that with, say, the spectral model and not have it explode.
Yeah. It's very difficult to predict necessarily how these models will change. If you change a parameter at some density scale, it can affect other density scales much more.
Any other questions? Oh, if not, let's thank